Good evening. You can go ahead and be turning in your Bibles to Isaiah chapter 7. And just by way of a very limited review, we're now into the third theme that we find running throughout the book of Isaiah, which is God's judgment for sin, and specifically starting out with what he declares there in the book with regard to the judgment that he had in store for the nation of Israel. Last time we looked at some of the statements in chapters 1 and 3, and in that first little section up through chapter 5, kind of the prologue of the book, we found that judgment had already commenced, had already started, because of the continual history of wickedness, really since the time of David, in the nation of Israel. And pointed out that there are about five sections in the book that deal with this topic. Those introductory sections. What we'll look at tonight is kind of chapters 7 through 12, which form somewhat of a unit. And we aren't going to look at all that, but we're going to take some passages out of that that deal with God's declaration of judgment. And then the remaining sections that will deal with this topic, and I'm not sure whether we'll split them up or take a couple of them together, but chapters 28 through 32, really talking about the pending Assyrian invasion. Chapter 36 through 38, which is a historical account of that invasion during Hezekiah's time, but also where we find the revelation of the Babylonian captivity that will occur. And then chapters 44 and 45, where it even looks beyond that to the Media-Persian invasion that will disrupt the Babylonian Empire and become the, what would that be, the second world empire, I guess, with Babylon being the first. But the raising up of Cyrus, which was prophesied in the book of Isaiah well before he was ever born. So a lot of neat things in the book of Isaiah. A lot of evidence for us of God's power. And that's part of what we're going to see tonight in this declaration of judgment and how it came about. It's just really a graphic example of what the ladies are going to be praying about next Tuesday, of the sovereignty of God and His power and His control over all things. So let's start with chapter 7. And the way we're going to break this down tonight, in chapter 7, we're kind of introduced to King Ahaz. We find out a little bit about him, and we're going to look at some of the background information on his reign. And so during this five-chapter section, God is revealing to Ahaz what he has in store for the kingdom, the southern kingdom, and the northern kingdom as well. That will go for chapter 7, chapter 8, and then we'll also look over at chapter 10 at a section of that passage. And then the rest of this 7 to 12 kind of really deals with prophetic revelation of Israel's future. So we'll come back to that at a future theme and pick up those sections as well, but not deal with them really tonight. So let's look at chapter 7. We'll read it in its entirety, and then we'll make some observations and comments about it. In the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, son of Uzziah, king of Judah, Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, the king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to wage war against it, but it could not yet mount an attack against it. When the house of David was told, Syria is in league with Ephraim, the heart of Ahaz and the heart of his people shook as the trees of the forest shake before the wind. And the Lord said to Isaiah, go out to meet Ahaz, you and Shear Jashub, your son, be glad you weren't named that, at the end of the conduit, but wait till you find out his brother's name, it's even worse. Wait for him at the end of the conduit of the upper pool on the highway to the washer's field, and say to him, be careful, be quiet, do not fear, do not let your heart be faint because of these two smoldering stumps of firebrands, at the fierce anger of Rezin and Syria and the son of Remaliah, because Syria with Ephraim and the son of Remaliah has devised evil against you. And just a comment, Ephraim was one of the names given to the 10 northern tribes. So they were called Israel, they were called Ephraim, those terms used interchangeably. They have devised evil against you, saying, let us go up against Judah and terrify it, and let us conquer it for ourselves, and set up the son of Tabeel as king in the midst of it. Thus says the Lord God, it shall not stand, and it shall not come to pass. For the head of Syria is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin. And within 65 years, Ephraim will be shattered from being a people. And the head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is the son of Remaliah. If you are not firm in faith, you will not be firm at all. Again, the Lord spoke to Ahaz, ask a sign. Let's see if I want to go that far. Yeah, we'll go ahead and go that far. Ask a sign of the Lord your God. Let it be as deep as Sheol or as high as heaven. But Ahaz said, I will not ask. I will not put the Lord to the test. And he said, hear then, O house of David, is it too little for you to weary men that you weary my God also? Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. He shall eat curds and honey when he knows how to refuse evil and choose good. For before the boy knows how to refuse evil and choose good, the land whose two kings you dread will be deserted. The Lord will bring upon you and upon your people and upon your father's house such days as have not come since the day that Ephraim departed from Judah, the king of Assyria. In that day the Lord will whistle for the fly that is in the end of the streams of Egypt and for the bee that is in the land of Assyria, and they will all come and settle in the steep ravines and in the clefts of the rock and on all the thorn bushes and on all the pastures. In that day the Lord will shave with the razor that is hired beyond the river with the king of Assyria, the head and the hair of the feet, and it will sweep away the beard also. In that day a man will keep alive a young cow and two sheep, and because of the abundance of milk that they give, he will eat curds, for everyone who is left in the land will eat curds and honey. In that day every place where there used to be 1,000 vines worth 1,000 shekels of silver will become briars and thorns. With bow and arrows a man will come there, for all the land will be briars and thorns. As for all the hills that used to be hoed with a hoe, you will not come there for fear of the briars and the thorns, but they will become a place where cattle are let loose and where sheep tread. So we're going to stop right now with that reading. But then I want to take you back and look at a little bit of background again. So go back to 2 Kings chapter 16. And this is just going to give you a bit of a glimpse, a pretty good glimpse, of how wicked this man Ahaz was as king of Judah. He's the third in succession of kings that Isaiah influenced. You had Uzziah, then you had Jotham, his son, and now you have Ahaz. And then Hezekiah, who was a good king, was Ahaz's son. So three out of the four were relatively good, but Ahaz was a real wicked king. So here in 2 Kings 16, let's read verses 1 through 9. In the 17th year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, Ahaz, the son of Jotham, king of Judah, began to reign. Ahaz was 20 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. And he did not do what was right in the eyes of the Lord his God, as his father David had done, but walked in the way of the kings of Israel. He even burned his son as an offering, according to the despicable practices of the nations whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. And he sacrificed and made offerings on the high places and on the hills and under every green tree. Then Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, son of Remaliah, king of Israel, came up to wage war on Jerusalem. And they besieged Ahaz, but could not conquer him. At that time, Rezin, the king of Syria, recovered Elath for Syria and drove the men of Judah from Elath. And the Edomites came to Elath, where they dwell to this day. So Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, I am your servant and your son. Come up and rescue me from the hand of the king of Syria, from the hand of the king of Israel, who are attacking me. And Ahaz took the silver and gold that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasures of the king's house and sent a present to the king of Assyria. And the king of Assyria listened to him. And the king of Assyria marched up against Damascus and took it, carrying its people captive to Kir, and killed Rezin. Now, let's also look over at 2 Chronicles 28, parallel passage that reveals a little bit of additional information. And we'll start there at verse 5. This is speaking of the king of Israel, the northern tribes, I believe. Therefore, the Lord gave him into the hand of the king of Syria, who defeated him and took captive a great number of his people and brought them to Damascus. He was also given into the hand of the king of Israel. Now, this is talking about Ahaz, I'm sorry. Who struck them with great force. So there we see these two nations being confederate that had had success in battle already against Ahaz. So there's no wonder that he was shaking in his boots when he found out they were approaching Jerusalem. It says, for Pekah the son of Remaliah killed 120,000 from Judah in one day. Now that's a pretty big slaughter. All of them men of valor, because they had forsaken the Lord, the God of their fathers. And Zichri, a mighty man of Ephraim, killed Masai, the king's son, and Azekam, the commander of the palace, and Elkanah, the next authority to the king. The men of Israel took captive 200,000 of their relatives, women, sons, and daughters. They also took much spoil from them and brought the spoil to Samaria. So, what do we see there about this Ahaz and about the kingdom at that time? We've already commented on his wickedness. He was just like the kings of the nations around him. There was no difference. He offered his son as a sacrifice to an idol. He worshiped the idols. He built high places for the idols. He led the nation away from God. And so God permitted his enemies to terrorize the nation. We saw right there, 120 men of valor killed in one day. So the army was being decimated. 200,000 women and children taken captive. And we find out later in that chapter that a prophet spoke to these Israelites and said, what are you doing taking your own people captive? And they released them and let them go back down to Judah. But they were being terrorized. So when Ahaz heard this plan that they were coming to attack, he was scared to death. We see that he sought protection in the form of an alliance with Assyria. So rather than call out to God, he says, I got a solution to this. We'll align ourselves with another nation that can defend us, the Assyrians. And we're going to find tonight that that ended up being the very country that would invade and successfully take most of Judah. So here in the middle of this, at chapter 7, we see that God steps in and reveals a plan to this wicked king. We find that Ahaz and the people were trembling. They were depending on the wrong things for their security. They were depending on their armies. They were depending on their wealth. They were depending on everything except God. And don't we find ourselves doing that? Both nationally. I read about things such as a certain party is going to diminish military spending. And I'm like, oh no, you can't do that. But the reality is, I don't care how strong our army is. If God wants this country to go down, it's going to go down. It doesn't matter how many bombs we have. It doesn't matter how many tanks or how many destroyers or how many jets or how many missiles or anything like that. It doesn't matter. If we do not call out to God to be our protector, we can have all that stuff and we'll still be defeated. So we don't need to be anxious about that stuff. We just don't. Personally, what do we depend on? What do we look to for security? We need to be looking to God. Not the size of our retirement account, not our intellect, not our job security, not whatever it is. You fill in the blank. We need to be looking to God as the one who has promised that He will be unwavering in His protection, in His guidance, and He has a beautiful plan for us for all eternity. We looked at that a few weeks ago. So in demonstration of mercy, God sends Isaiah to meet Ahaz. I would have simply said, sat back and laughed. You know, it's like, you're getting what you deserve, you fool. But God didn't like that. Even in the midst of his wickedness, God sends a prophet. And he always does. He always warns people and gives them ample opportunity to repent, doesn't he? Look at in Noah's day, 120 days of preaching. Years, thank you. 120 years of preaching, and people did not repent. In Jonah's day, he went into Nineveh, and he declared the judgment of God. He warned a wicked people that God was getting ready to judge. All through the Scriptures, we find God, in mercy, warning people that judgment is coming. So here he sends Isaiah. He tells him to take his son. And there was a message in that. His son's name means a remnant will return. So here's Ahaz trying to imagine that he's safe in his country. And here's a young child that's been named a remnant will return. That doesn't bode well. You know, that's not a real good message to hear, that only a small group of people are going to return here. He didn't have a clue what it meant, but it wasn't a positive sign. So he sent him with his son. He sent him to meet him, said at the water conduit. And most commentators believe that Ahaz was there, probably getting ready to stop up the water supply that fed Jerusalem so that the enemy armies couldn't penetrate the city like that. Now that would be a pretty unpleasant situation, to be locked in the city without adequate water. And it gets dirtier by the day. And so God, again, in His mercy, said, you don't need to do that. And He gives Ahaz a message. He says, these wicked kings that have evil intent against you, they have a plan, they've laid it out, they've got armies, they've already taken most of your fighting men away. You have no chance, my friend. But it's not going to stand. God is in control. And the evil intent of these enemies was going to be disrupted. Now, to me, I think we should draw great comfort from that. The enemy may rattle their saber at us. They may surround us. They may have us outnumbered. Whatever your situation, you may feel in desperation. But you can rest assured, it will not stand unless God permits it. You may not like your circumstances. You may be very anxious about what's happening in your life. You may not understand what's happening in your life. But you can rest assured that God is in control of it. Every detail. He knows, He understands, He's controlling the events. What is it Lehman Strauss used to say? The scenes that He's behind. God is behind the scenes, controlling the scenes that He's behind. And that's true. And again, we don't understand a lot of times why things are happening. We wouldn't pick them out. But what's our promise? What's our promise in Romans 8:28? For we know that all things work together for good to them that love God. Whatever has happened to you, whatever will happen to you, it will work out for good. Now, I had a little practical example of this past week. On Friday, Kim and I met in Greensboro. We were selling one of our cars to a niece, and then we were going to enjoy a night together. And she says, oh, you got a letter today, a registered mail letter from some lady in Wilmington. And I'm thinking, huh? That's not good. I don't know what it is, but it's not good. And so I get home, and some of you would appreciate this. I had a letter from Diener. Anybody know what Diener is? Okay, yeah, all right. It is the state version of the EPA. And they were saying that some contamination had been found in well water at some houses out adjacent to my plant. And they're saying that I need to do all kinds of work to remediate this. And I went back and I looked at all of our environmental records. We have never had either of those substances on our site. So how did they correlate that? There is no correlation. It's bogus. It's bizarre. But my stomach was in a knot. And I mean, my mind was going everywhere. And it's amazing how the Lord works. I was preparing to speak on this. I'd already been through this. I use a one-year Bible in my quiet time. The day after, what chapter do you think was scheduled in my one-year Bible? Isaiah chapter 7. It shall not stand. Now, I'm not saying that I won't have work to do, that I may not have a hassle, but boy, was that reassuring. That I can be at peace. I can be at peace knowing that whatever might come is only allowed by my God. He's in control. He's in control of some technician at Diener that doesn't know what they're doing. All right? He's in control of everything. And so we need to take heart in that and rest assured that He is working all things for our good. Isaiah reveals to Ahaz that within 65 years, the two powers that were threatening him would be brought to their knees. So detailed is our God. Not in a few years. In 65 years, this is going to happen. And it happened. It happened. The kingdom of Israel was dispersed, disbanded. Assyria would come in. They would take the Israelites, kill some of them, transplant them to other countries, transplant foreigners in. That's why the Samaritans were so hated by the Jews, because of all this transplantation and intermarriage that occurred under the Assyrian invasion. And so, at the last part of this little segment in verse 9, God challenges Ahaz to be a man of faith. Look at what it says down at verse 9. If you are not firm in faith, you will not be firm at all. Well, was that a true description? He was not firm in faith. He had no faith. He depended on anything and everything but God. And so he was wishy-washy. He went with the tide. It's like the double-minded man in James. But even in the midst of his sin, God is appealing to him. He's inviting him to a relationship where he could depend on the God that wanted to protect him. So then the next little part, starting at verse 10, God speaks again. He says to Ahaz, ask a sign. I know you have no faith, so just ask a sign and let me show you something to prove what I'm saying. So Ahaz feigns righteousness. Oh, no, no. I can't test God. I won't ask a sign. And so God speaks again. He says, hear then, O house of David, is it too little for you to weary men? Will you weary my God also? Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. Now that's a pretty familiar prophecy, isn't it? We find it over in Matthew chapter 1, where it's specifically declared to be a prophetic statement of the virgin birth of Christ. But the liberal commentators have had a field day trying to explain away that term, virgin, and claiming it was talking about Isaiah's second son, which is going to be dealt with in chapter 8. Now here's an interesting point. Number one, we know that's not true because we see in Matthew, and if you believe in the inspiration of the Scripture, that confirms that this verse spoke of the virgin birth of the Messiah. So we have no doubt in that. But think about this. What was his name going to be? What does it mean? God with us. Isaiah's son was going to be named Maher Shalal Hashbaz. It basically means the enemy is coming quick. Now, what a contrast. God with us, the enemy's coming quick. Yeah, that was a prophecy about his son that was going to be born. Makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? He's made foolish the wisdom of this world. So we see here this declaration, and it's given to Ahaz as a sign. Well, we know it didn't occur for like 700 and some years later. So how was it possibly a sign to Ahaz? He would never see it. He would never know it happened. How was it a sign? I think, and this is just my opinion, I think it's a sign in the very fact that God was reaffirming the promise that the Messiah would come to the house of Israel through the tribe of Judah, of which Ahaz was part of. He was a descendant of David, of the house of Judah. So God was reaffirming, I am still going to work through your branch of this nation to bring the Messiah. Now, maybe you can come up with a different reason why it was a sign, but I think that is what God was saying, is that I am reaffirming to you in the midst of your wickedness, in the midst of this judgment that is going to overtake the nation, that I'm still working. And my plan is still on track, and the Messiah is going to come, and we're going to find beautiful prophecies all through the book of Isaiah about the coming Messiah. Now, he goes on, and he makes another fairly confusing statement. He says that before the child, before the boy knows how to refuse good and evil, now, I don't know what age that is. Some people would say it's probably 18 or 19. Some people would say it's maybe 3 or 4 or 1 or 2 or something like that. But before the child would understand the difference between what was right and wrong, the land that these two kings were coming from would be deserted. Now, that statement's true about the Messiah, isn't it? That happened before he was old enough to discern good and evil. He wasn't even born yet, but I don't think that's what it's getting at. Who did Isaiah take with him to visit the king? His youngest son at the time, his only son at the time. And he was apparently pretty young. And most commentators think he probably was carrying his youngest son. And when he made this statement, before the boy knows how to determine good and evil, these countries are going to be done away with. And that was true as well, because it happened very quickly. And he goes on then to share what was going to happen, that was going to happen at the hands of the Assyrians, which, by the way, Ahaz had entered into an alliance with. He was depending on the people that were going to be his enemy to provide protection. What a foolish thing. Well, let's go to chapter 8. Here we find more information on this Assyrian threat. We'll start with verses 1 through 10. The Lord said to me, take a large tablet and write on it in common characters, belonging to Maher Shalal Hashbaz. Say that fast 5 times. And I will get reliable witnesses, Uriah and the priest, and Zechariah the son of Jeberechiah, to attest for me. And I went to the prophetess, and she conceived and bore a son. The Lord said to me, call his name Maher Shalal Hashbaz. For before the boy knows how to cry, my father and my mother, the wealth of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria will be carried away before the king of Assyria. The Lord spoke to me again. Because this people have refused the waters of Shiloh that flow gently, and rejoice over Rezin and the son of Remaliah, therefore, behold, the Lord is bringing up against them the waters of the river, mighty and many, the king of Assyria and all his glory. And it will rise over all its channels and go over all its banks, and will sweep on into Judah, and will overflow and pass on, reaching even to the neck, and its outspread wings will fill the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. Be broken, you people, be shattered. Give ear, all you far countries. Strap on your armor and be shattered. Strap on your armor and be shattered. Take counsel together, but it will come to nothing. Speak a word, but it will not stand, for God is with us. Now, so what do we see happening there? Ahaz once again prepares, Isaiah once again prepares a message for Ahaz. First of all, he writes on a big tablet, a sign. He created a sign, and it had this name that he was going to end up naming his son. It said, belonging to, what's his name? And that literally means the spoil speeds, the prey hastens. The enemy's coming. So here was a big sign, a billboard for Ahaz to see. The enemy's coming. So don't get so comfortable from the fact that I've told you that these first two enemies are going to be taken care of, because you still are in trouble. And I'm still going to bring judgment. It's just not going to be by them. In other words, I'm working it my way. I've got a plan laid out, and I'm totally in control of that plan, and it's going to happen just like I say that it's going to happen. So then he tells Isaiah to name his son that name. And notice verse 18. Isaiah says, "Behold, I and the children whom the Lord has given me are signs and portents in Israel from the Lord of hosts." So God was using Isaiah and his family to be a message to a wicked nation. And he was obedient to that. In verses 5 through 10, the Lord again speaks, telling Ahaz that the very nation that he's depending on for protection will overrun Judah. It says, reaching even to the neck. Now, you may remember the account of Hezekiah. We're going to look at that later in chapters 36 through 38. How the Assyrian army had gathered around Jerusalem. They were talking to the people on the wall. They were talking in Hebrew, if you remember, so that everybody could hear what they were saying. And they were saying, "Why do you think that your God is going to stop us from overtaking this city?" So they had already overtaken much of Judah. Now they're centered at Jerusalem. And they're telling these people, who again are terrified, "Why do you think your God's going to stop us when all the gods of all the other countries have meant nothing in defending their people?" And then we find they were right to the neck, ready to choke it off, and God intervenes, and he takes them away. So that is all prophesied right here. By looking at 2 Kings chapter 16, and we won't turn back to it, we find that Ahaz ignored the warnings. In fact, after Assyria had come in and defeated the northern tribes and defeated Syria, Ahaz took a little trip. He went up to Damascus, which was now under the control of the king of Assyria. And he was so impressed by what he saw, he came back to Jerusalem and he had the priest build him an altar just like the one he had seen up there. And he desecrated the altar of God. This man was worthless. He was absolutely despicable in God's sight. So he had all these warnings, one after another, and he refused to believe. Well, let's go forward then. Turn to chapter 10. So again, God is giving Ahaz a view of what's getting ready to happen. In chapter 10, starting at verse 5, we find that he begins to speak to the Assyrians, because he's going to use them as an instrument of his judgment. So let's start with verse 5, and we'll read down to verse 19 right now. Assyria, the rod of my anger. The staff in their hands is my fury. Against the godless nation I will send him, and against the people of my wrath I command him, to take spoil, to seize plunder, to tread them down like the mire of the streets. So Assyria is the called of God, are they not? In fact, they're the chosen of God, are they not? They're the elect of God for a purpose, for the purpose of judgment. So a perfect example of those being elect that are not believers. Okay? That's just a little tidbit, you know, to throw in. Look at verse 7. But he does not so intend in his heart, and his heart does not so think. But it is in his heart to destroy and to cut off nations, not a few. For he says, are not my commanders all kings? Is not Calno like Carchemish? Is not Hamath like Arpad? Is not Samaria like Damascus? As my hand has reached to the kingdoms of the idols, whose carved images were greater than those of Jerusalem and Samaria, shall I not do to Jerusalem and her idols as I have done to Samaria and her images? In other words, their God's no different than all the gods of the lands that I've already taken over. He's not a real God. He's just like the idols of all these other nations. When the Lord has finished all his work on Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, he will punish the speech of the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria and the boastful look in his eyes. For he says, by the strength of my hand I have done it, and by my wisdom, for I have understanding, I remove the boundaries of people and plunder their treasures. Like a bull I bring down those who sit on thrones. My hand has found like a nest the wealth of the peoples. As one gathers eggs that have been forsaken, so have I gathered all the earth. And there was none that moved a wing or opened a mouth or chirped. So this guy's pretty full of himself. He is, and this was before it happened, this is being prophesied, but he is really caught up with his power. We see the epitome of pride in this worldly leader. So God has chosen him and raised him up to be used to judge his people, but he's crossing the line. He's going beyond what God really wanted him to do, and now God's going to punish him. So again, we see a pretty good example of God's sovereignty and man's free will combined together, working together in unison in this particular situation. So then verse 15 through 19, we're not going to read it because we're running out of time, but it's basically God's response. Shall the axe boast over him who hews with? In other words, you're nothing but a stick. You're a stick in my hand, and I'm using you to accomplish my purpose. So how dare you lift your heart in pride? And so he goes on and he predicts the destruction ultimately of the Assyrians. Now let's jump back, and we're going to close with this. Chapter 8, verses 11 through 22. And you're going to have to read this if you want to read it. But basically, God is now speaking to Isaiah. And he's saying, be a man of faith. Don't let all this stuff disturb your faith. He says, don't call a conspiracy what everybody calls a conspiracy. The word literally is treason. And what would happen to the prophets of God in that day when they spoke against the king? They were called traitors. They were considered to be an act of treason. And, you know, you could be influenced by that. I'm sure you've all been in a situation where somebody accuses you of something, or they say, I can't think of a real good, you make a comment and they say, well, you're just a racist. And you're like, I'm not a racist. I got to prove I'm not a racist. You know, and that would be the temptation for a prophet. When somebody says, you're committing treason. Oh, no, wait a minute. No, I love this country. I'm not committing treason. And so God is challenging Isaiah, be true to me. Don't be influenced by the trends in your culture. Don't be influenced by what everybody's saying. Don't be influenced by the popular opinion. But you be true to me and you fear me and don't fear what men say. Now, isn't that a pretty good advice for us today? Be true to God. Let's not be too concerned about what our culture says. You know, I had another thought the other day about this whole cultural influence thing. Who created the first culture? Come on, guys. God. And it was perfect, wasn't it? And ever since, it's been going downhill. So why do we think that there's something mystical and magical about our culture and its definition of what's right and wrong? We got it backwards, folks. We need to look at God's culture as defined in His Word and forget what our culture says is right and wrong. That's enough for tonight.